So now we're going to begin talking about our Leelas with Srila Prabhupada. And I remembered some things I didn't say in the last class. I can't remember the years exactly, but I think it must have been 1970. I would say 1970. I was present in Los Angeles. How many of you have been to Los Angeles? Anybody? One, two. Not you? Where are you from?
Me, Atlanta.
All right, so.
Atlanta.
I believe it was 1970, but I was present for the installation of Rukmini Dwarkadish. And the devotees did something very bad, and Prabhupada was very upset. And it's interesting, because Prabhupada didn't get upset a lot. And it was always, as we've been discussing, it was always very, very encouraging and very blissful and absorbed in Krishna consciousness. But there were times when Prabhupada got very upset because offenses were made to the deities. And this is one case. So they're installing Rukmini Dwarkadish. Rukmini Dwarkadish are probably 4 feet high or 4.5 feet high. Something like that. And so what they did is they built a platform to put in the middle of the temple, and they were going to do the initiation and the Abhishek and everything in the temple. Middle of the temple. Actually, I saw a video of this. I believe it must have been 1970. So there was a rug, like we're sitting on rugs. There was one of these rugs, I believe, that they use with the pandal tents. There was a rug. I don't know what it was used for. So they put that rug on the platform. They must not have been doing an Abhishek because there was a rug. This was early in the movement, so installations were not very sophisticated. So they laid the rug down, and then they placed the deities on the rug. And it must have been that Prabhupada was not there while they were doing it, but he came in. And then he understood that that rug was the same rug that devotees used in the temple to walk on, to sit on, to stand on, like that. So Prabhupada got very upset. So this rug, this dirty rug that you stand on now, you're putting on this platform, which is like an altar, and you're putting Krishna there. He was very, very upset. So at that point in the movement, you know, we didn't know a lot about anything, and we didn't know a lot about deity worship. And Prabhupada was anxious. He had anxiety about us taking care of deities, and we needed to take care of deities, but he had anxiety about us taking care of deities because we were not born Brahmins, and we could make offenses. So this indicated, this was 1970, must have been 1970. So at this time in 1970, I think I may have mentioned, some of Prabhupada's godbrothers were minimizing Prabhupada. And some of that minimization had filtered in from one disciple to another, because the disciples in India were hearing things which weren't so respectful about Prabhupada and minimizing. And that was getting back And Prabhupada heard some of these things. And Prabhupada also noticed the behavior of some disciples or behavior within our movement that indicated a concern on his part that some contamination was infiltrating. So something of this nature where we're not taking proper care of the deities was very concerning to him because he saw this contamination affecting. And anywhere where we were falling off standard, he felt that there was contamination entering the movement. So we might not think things that made Prabhupada upset were very important or very big, but he saw it as a problem because he felt there was a bad influence. So I'll tell another story. Maybe you've heard this story. It's quite interesting. As we know, when Prabhupada came into the temple, he would greet the deities. And at least in Los Angeles, they have a stand for Charanamrita between Gornitai's altar and Radha Krishna's altar, right? Rukmini Dwarkadish. So Prabhupada would pay obeisances to Gornitai, and then he would move forward. So in the space between Gornitai's altar and Rukmini Dwarkadish's altar, there was the stand, and he would take Charanamrita, and then he would pay obeisances to Rukmini Dwarkadish and go to the next altar, pay obeisances to Jagannath. And so, as you know, we mix the Charanamrita, which bathes the deities, we mix it with yogurt, and then we add some sugar or something to sweeten it. So occasionally a mistake is made in the kitchen and you add salt instead of sugar. Of course, I've never had Charanamrita with salt. Have you? Any of you? Never had? No. Well, this Charanamrita, a devotee put salt in it instead of sugar. And so, seems like an innocent mistake. Sometimes we do that when we're cooking. Put salt in the sweet rice instead of sugar, or sugar in the sabji, which is... Sugar in the sabji is okay, but salt in the sweet rice, no. It doesn't work. So you might think, well, it was an innocent mistake, and not a big thing, because it's not that we put salt where we should have put sugar in a drink and offered it to Krishna. And when Prabhupada tasted it, he stopped. He was really, really concerned. And he said, "Who has done this?" Or something like that. "Who has done this?" And so one devotee, you know, he said, "It is salt." He took it and he said, "It is salt," meaning salt, not sugar. "Who has done this?" And then the devotee kind of, I don't know, you could say foolishly, childishly, said, almost laughing, maybe. I did, Srila Prabhupada. He was really, really upset. Because as I said, he felt that there was an influence contaminating our movement, and he saw this as a sign. This is how he saw it. That there's negligence in the deity department. Now you might say, it wasn't for the deities, but it's in the deity department. So he's very, very concerned. And as you may know, Prabhupada was very concerned that we would change standards. So he said, you know, my big worry is you would change deity standards after I go. But, you know, because it's fixed. So he saw this like that a little bit. Like you're changing standards, you're making mistakes. It was really, really upset, and it was really obviously a shock to all of us because we didn't expect it. So I don't know if you know the story, but the deities in Dallas were found in India, and they were actually keeping a door open for a shop. And they're very big deities. And they're very old, maybe 500 years, right? 500 years, but I think they were just a doorstop, just holding a door open. Anyway, for some reason, the devotees, one devotee had painted the whole deity. Something. He painted the whole thing. I don't know. And then either Prabhupada found out or this or that, and then they had taken turpentine, and then, you know turpentine? It's like paint remover. Turpentine, do you use that? Maybe when you do oil painting to clean your brushes. Anyway, it cleans paint. Cleans oil paint. And they had done, put that. So when Prabhupada found this out, he was extremely angry that you're putting bathing Krishna with turpentine. So, again, I mean, Prabhupada, he would get very angry whenever Krishna was offended like that. And you see also, I think the times Prabhupada became the most angry is when the deities were offended. Just like imagine you had a child and somebody mistreated a child. Somebody bathed your child in turpentine. How upset you would be. Or you had someone was caring for your child and they put salt in the milk instead of sugar. You know, you'd get very upset. So whenever anything was directly done that was offensive to Krishna, Prabhupada became very upset. And then we also have seen that he became extremely upset with Mayavad philosophy, especially in the presence of those who were pushing and pushing and pushing their Mayavad philosophy. Sometimes he became like thunder and would scream. Because Bhaktisiddhanta said that the Mayavadis are cutting off Krishna's limbs by saying he has no form. So, and then again, it would be like saying, your child has no head, no arms, no legs. You know, how would you feel? So that's why Prabhupada became so upset. Now, I promised last week I would describe a ritual that went on in the Los Angeles temple. And I've described it before, so some of you may have heard it. And you can also see this ritual if you get the following Srila Prabhupada's videos and you go to Los Angeles 1970, you'll see this ritual. You'll see both the rituals. The one I described last week was the ritual of Prabhupada's morning walk. When he would leave, everyone would greet him and some devotees would run after the car. When the car would leave, they'd run. But whoever wasn't engaged in service would come out of the temple and then they would get to see Prabhupada and then he would go off for his morning walk. And you might say, well, if Prabhupada at that time, 1972, was staying in Los Angeles for 3 months, so you'd see him every day in Bhagavatam class. So you might say, well, why would everyone want to go out and see him off on his morning walk and then come back and greet him because you see him in the class, right? Does that make sense? Because every day, the whole temple would, when Prabhupada would go on the morning walk, they'd all go to just see him get in the car. And then they'd all meet him outside the temple to see him get outside the car and come back in the temple. So you might think, why? And the only answer I can give you is that we could never get enough of seeing Prabhupada. That even it was so special to see him. Now you might think, well, he's just going down the stairs and getting in a car. What's special about that? Everything that Prabhupada did is special. Is there a song like that? Everything you do is special? There must be. Is there? A song? Everything you do is special? It's got to be, right? Somebody look it up on YouTube. Everything you do is special. There has to be a song like that. I mean, we can make a movie and take the song and do a video and we'll just have Prabhupada doing different things. Okay, I can only speak from my personal experience, but best way I can describe it is Prabhupada was unique, and therefore everything he did and said was unique. It wasn't like anybody else. And every time you'd see him was new. It was like new, like Krishna's Navayovana. So like seeing him was always interesting. It was always exciting. It was always somewhat mesmerizing. I also found it, you could say, although this is not the right way to say it, but for lack of a better word, entertaining in the sense that because he didn't do things like anyone else, it was entertaining in that sense to just watch him, how he would move, how he would smile, how he would speak. It was entertaining. I have to think of a better word. Entertaining is not good, but fascinating. That's a better word. It was very fascinating. And that's just more external, what to speak of being in Prabhupada's presence. Just to get that association for that 2 minutes that he would come outside of his room, onto the street, get in the car. How long could that take? 2 minutes? But that 2 minutes was amazing. And then to be able to see him just drive off, we understood. It didn't take for Prabhupada to leave us to understand how special he was. We understood it. Now, we may understand now even more than ever how special he was, but we understood it. And how did we understand? Because we understood the Krishna consciousness movement was planting itself in America. We could see that, it was clear. It was here to stay and it was growing. And it was a, we say in English, a force to be reckoned with. It means it was there, it's a force in the world, and it's expanding its influence. And it's only a matter of time before, like the roots of a tree, are just going to go everywhere, and it's going to find its way into different aspects of society and create major changes in the world. We understood that. We may not have understood how far that was true, but we understood that Prabhupada is the person that's doing this, that's creating a revolution. And just to give you a context, the movement is now going to be celebrating its 50th anniversary, right? Now, we're describing a time when the movement was 6 years old, and I guess at this time, maybe 1,000 people, 1,000 devotees. So it's still quite small. It's still in its infancy. And that was an extremely exciting time to be a devotee. Because you're watching. It's like when you have a baby. There's a saying, you know, they say kids grow up really fast. You know, relish the time with them. You know, a lot of people are working and they don't have time to see their kids, or they avoid them. They say that, you know, don't neglect them. Spend time with them. They grow up very fast. So it was something like you watch your children grow up year by year by year by year. So we're watching the ISKCON baby grow. And it's very exciting. It was very, very exciting. So the movement was exciting, and that made Prabhupada even more exciting because he was the one who was behind the exciting movement. So therefore, it was exciting just to see him for 2 minutes in his car. What to speak if you got to go on a morning walk, which by Krishna's mercy, I did. Now, I don't know the dates of all the morning walks, and we're trying to go chronologically, so I'll tell one story of one morning walk. I'll tell two. I think I only went on three. Anyway, there was a devotee named Swarup Dhammadhar who was studying at the University of California in Irvine, which was about 50 or 60 miles from Los Angeles. And he was from Manipur. He was doing his PhD. And he was a Vaishnav from Manipur. And he was a scientist. And so, he was a Vaishnav from birth. He was very attracted to ISKCON. And he met Prabhupada. And he began attending Prabhupada's morning walks every day. And they were talking science. And this was the first time we heard Prabhupada speak extensively about maybe if you put the fans on in the back, it's okay. If that'll help. Yeah, I just can't get air right into the mic. Depends how noisy they are. I think they're all there. Or if they go really slow, if they're really, really slow, it's okay. I guess you have to turn the switches. Yes. Everybody's dying here. And it's not even the summer yet. Yeah, if they're slow, it's okay. Having trouble getting them all on. Huh? What happened? They're all supposed to be over there. No? Or those are lights? She's trying to figure it out. Okay. All right. So this devotee, Swarup Dhammadhar, was going with Prabhupada. And so, because he was a scientist, they were having all these discussions about God and science and evolution. As you probably all know, those discussions were recorded in the book, Life Comes from Life. So this really got Prabhupada stimulated, talking about evolution, science, and then, I don't know why, Prabhupada started talking about the moon. And he was saying, he was making the point that you have Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, because those days are named after the planets. So Sunday obviously is the Sunday, Monday is the moon day. Tuesday, I think, is what, Mars? No? Wednesday is Mercury. Thursday? Jupiter? Venus. Saturday, Saturn Day. And today's Saturn Day. And Sunday, yeah, okay. So Prabhupada was on the morning walk, and then he was asking devotees, why does Sunday come before Monday? You know, it's kind of an interesting question for your spiritual master to ask you. Why does Sunday come before Monday? Nobody really knew what Prabhupada was getting at. Then he said, because sun is closer, then the moon is further, then Mars, Jupiter, Mercury, Jupiter. Yeah. Anyway, you understand the order of the planets. He said, the moon comes after the sun because it's further away. And then he said, therefore I say they didn't go to the moon. I was on the morning walk. So he was, you know, like Prabhupada would get into these kinds of discussions. He liked debates. He liked it when devotees would present arguments. Prabhupada, the scientists say, or people say that. And then Prabhupada would give answers. A lot of time he was giving answers that, for our reference, so we could understand how to answer these different accusations. So I was standing next to Prabhupada, I was right next to him, and he was saying that when I was a child, or when I was married, I brought my son to see a movie called Godzilla. Godzilla is a famous movie. You've seen Godzilla? And now they have Godzilla, the comeback of Godzilla. They have a modern version of Godzilla. When I was young, it was... But Godzilla is this monster who's taller than all the buildings. What does he come in? What does he destroy? New York City? He comes and he destroys New York City. You know? You imagine a big monster just knocking the city down. Godzilla. So Prabhupada described it in what he understood the motion picture industry in which they fabricate a situation in which they create a situation which they can film. So they create like a city out of cardboard and clouds. He said they can make cotton clouds and like that, and they fabricate it, and then they have like a little lizard or something, and it looks like he's destroying New York City, something like that. So he said they could fabricate a moon landing. And then a devotee said that there's a part of America, it's just desert. It's called Arizona. There's just this big desert. And the devotee said either it was his opinion or the opinion of others that where they landed, well, it was said, no, they said, the moon looks like Arizona. That was the comments. And they showed the space landing, they said, it looks like Arizona. So Prabhupada said, it looks like Arizona? That means that's where they staged the filming, in Arizona. That was his comment. So that's what I heard with my own ears. The rest of the conversation I can't remember, but that I remember. Another time I was on a morning walk. There was a... It may have been a professor named Stilson Judah, or it may have been another professor. There were some professors that liked Prabhupada and his movement very much, and they would come to meet him. And whenever they came, they would go on the morning walks. They would go on all the morning walks. The VIPs, if they were around, they'd get to be on morning walks. So if you were a professor and you liked Krishna consciousness, that was good. And the devotees would bring you to meet Prabhupada, and you could spend time with him in his room on his morning walks and so forth. So this man, whoever it was either him or another professor. There's another one, Mr. Wolf or Dr. Wolf, I think, who was very favorable. And so they were theologians, which means they understood the Bible. So there was some discussion in the Bible about Bible verses. And so this point came up that Prabhupada is describing God. He's describing Krishna. And the point came up, and this point was brought up to Prabhupada. He said, Prabhupada, in the Bible, it says no one has seen God. But you're saying, here is God. Has seen God. No man has seen God. But you're saying, here's God. You're describing him and you're saying, here's God. So it seems like a contradiction. So that, theologian is there, and so they're asking these questions. They want to see what Prabhupada's going to say. And Prabhupada said, "No fool has seen God. I am not a fool. I have seen God." So what do you think the devotees said when Prabhupada said that? "Jai Prabhupada." And Prabhupada said that with great power and confidence. "No fool has seen God. I am not a fool. I have seen God." Wow. So now you're walking with someone who's saying, "I have seen God." That's powerful. You imagine how all of us felt when Prabhupada said that. Can you imagine? You also have to understand that the impact that Prabhupada had on us was multiplied by the gap between us in age and spiritual advancement. He was much, much older and much, much more Krishna conscious. So his influence on us was dramatic. Dramatic. So, as I was saying last time, I got to walk on the same beaches with Prabhupada as the places that I grew up and walked on before I was a devotee. So that was kind of special in the sense that you feel like that you've been liberated. I'd go there so I would remember what I did there as a teenager. And now I'm with my spiritual master. That life is finished, but we're back in the same places. It's kind of interesting. I don't know if you've ever had that experience, if you've been to the same place you were, the exact same place, doing something Krishna conscious, right where you were. Like where Rath Yatra is in Los Angeles. Well, I spent a lot of time there, Venice Beach, Santa Monica, and it goes right to the very places I spent my whole childhood. So it's kind of powerful that now you're in the same place and you're doing Krishna consciousness in the very same places, in the very same streets that you did so many stupid things. That was really, really, really special to be with Prabhupada in those very places. So, Prabhupada would always come back somehow or other. He always knew when to come back, or devotees would tell him. But he seemed to have a perfect sense of time. He knew when to stop walking, he had that sense, or others had the sense. Just walk one direction, turn around, and then get back in the car so they could come back and greet the deities on time. And so, at that time, devotees developed a ritual. As I said, they all greeted Prabhupada when he was leaving, and they had a ritual where they all greeted him when he was returning. And the ritual, you should, if you can get the video of Los Angeles 1970, you should get it. Because you can see the ritual. And the ritual is, Prabhupada gets out of his car, all the devotees line up in two lines, and Prabhupada walks through the middle of the line, and each devotee bows one by one and gives Prabhupada a flower. And I think Prabhupada has a basket of flowers, and then he's giving each devotee a flower. So he goes up, and I think there were two lines, flower here, flower there, like that. And he would do that every day, exchanging of flowers. Every day when he would come back from his morning walk, that was the ritual. Exchanging of flowers, reciprocation with the devotees. And it was, it was quite special for the devotees to interact with their spiritual master like that. And Prabhupada's interaction with his disciples was very much an interaction of encouragement and affection. Very fatherly or grandfatherly. And I think I mentioned this before, but we can talk a little bit about it. You in relation to your spiritual master, you always tend to feel that you're letting him down, or that you always tend to feel that you're impure. He's so pure and I'm so impure. So There's a sense of maybe feeling shameful in his presence, maybe a sense of feeling guilty, maybe even a sense of worthlessness or hopelessness. Prabhupada, if we felt that way, it was not because Prabhupada made us feel that way. It was just because we felt that way. But Prabhupada, you never in Prabhupada's presence ever felt that he was judging you. And if you were ever so-called judged, it was only to improve you. But you never felt that you weren't good enough. You know, Prabhupada's going to judge you, whatever, how you look, how you chant, how you recite the Sanskrit, how you dance. You never felt any sense of judgment, but you always felt that he was very happy. Whatever you were doing, he was very happy. So you can see in this video this sense of just happiness to reciprocate with his disciples and encourage them, because this is what they wanted to do. So it was kind of like the sense I get. It was like, Prabhupada, we give you flowers. So it was like him, he's agreeing to this little ritual of reciprocation every morning, just exchanging flowers and smiles and bowing down. And for the devotees, it just made their day to get a flower from Prabhupada, to give him a flower. Right? And Prabhupada knew that, so he was willing to do that. He would reciprocate. Because he knew it was important for the devotees. And I think, personally, I think much of what Prabhupada did was to extract affection from our heart, to instill affection within us for him, because that was our real link to Krishna consciousness. He was our real link. And that link was the affection. And so if he could instill that affection, then we were solid. Because Prabhupada once said, if you have that affection for your guru, then you'll follow the principles, you'll follow the practices. You know, maybe out of your own determination, you may fail. But out of your love, you'll do it. So I think Prabhupada would often do what would... things which would instill that love more deeply within our hearts. So that connection became stronger, thicker, and therefore we became more Krishna conscious through that connection. Now another thing that Prabhupada did that we liked very much was throw flowers. Would you like to get a flower petals thrown on you by Prabhupada? Wow. That would be really nice, right? So sometimes in the kirtan, you know, Prabhupada, after Guru Puja, he's full of flowers. So sometimes in the kirtan we get ecstatic, then he would throw the flowers, which would then make the kirtan more ecstatic, as you could imagine, right? Getting showered by flowers that have touched Prabhupada's body or touched his feet. But there's two things you may not know, and they're quite interesting, and these are not things that go on anymore in our movement, but devotees were very ecstatic, ecstatico. How do you say it in Russian? Ecstasy. How do you say it in Italian?
Ecstasy.
Wow, so that's all. Ecstatico. And how do they say it in Hindi? Bhava. Bhava? Maybe. So the devotees were obviously very ecstatic to be in Prabhupada's presence. So when Prabhupada chanted Jai Radha Madhava, the devotees would get up and dance. They were so enthusiastic. They wouldn't sit. This is, you know, just before class. And so the way that Prabhupada introduced kirtan, the way he did it in New York, or the way it transpired naturally, is that when he'd start the kirtan before a class, everyone would be sitting down. And gradually, the kirtan, he would build the kirtan up. Very, very gradually. And people would begin to stand up. And so, later in the kirtan, they would stand up and they would dance. And then Prabhupada would build it up to a climax, and then it was finished. Not like it would start real fast, build up, then start over, build up, start. It would just start very, very slow. Build, build up. And then devotees would gradually get up, start dancing, till the point where everybody was up and dancing. So many of those early kirtans were sit-down kirtans. And you would see sometimes Prabhupada, then he would also sometimes stand up. So that's what happened during the Jairada Madhava. That Prabhupada would start chanting gradually. Because we had that habit, devotees would get up. And so by the end of the kirtan, before Bhagavatam class, everyone was dancing in ecstasy, Jairada Madhava. And somehow or other that stopped, but that was going on. And then at the end of every class, Prabhupada would have kirtan. You finish class. I don't know if you ever, if you notice, you'll notice this now if you watch the videos. But after class, he takes off his glasses like that. They give him kartals. Then usually a devotee will lead kirtan. I think I got to lead a kirtan once, maybe, for Prabhupada like that. And someone will lead a kirtan, maybe for 10, 15 minutes after class. Usually, Prabhupada's classes were about a half an hour. And he didn't have questions. So then there was time left for kirtan. And so he was always having kirtan. Kirtan, kirtan, kirtan. Every evening in New York, they would have kirtan, and then they would have class. So that's something else. Did anybody know that? And Prabhupada had kirtan. After every Bhagavatam class, there was always kirtan. So, yes, these at this time Prabhupada was speaking on from the second canto, second chapter. Verses like, "Did the bellows of the blacksmith not breathe?" In other words, bellows breathe. So human beings breathing, if they're not Krishna conscious, they're no better than bellows. Bellows. Do the peacocks not have eyes? Those who don't see the form of Krishna, their eyes are like the plumes of a peacock. Do the snakes not have ears? That ear that doesn't hear about Krishna, it's like the ears of a snake. That one who doesn't chant Krishna's name is like the croaking of a frog, like these verses. So, as I was saying last time, last class, this was all new for us. This was all new information, so it was very, we were all very rapt in attention, listening to Prabhupada. And a lot of times Prabhupada would give the class, he'd begin talking, and then he would close his eyes. And he just, and occasionally he would make a point, and then he would look up and open his eyes, and lift it, put his hand up, and then go back and close his eyes. Or so make a point, look around, and then go start talking, close his eyes to focus. And one thing that we experienced when Prabhupada would speak. And you might listen to some of Prabhupada's lectures and maybe you think they seem simple, basic, not so complex, intricate, overly intellectual, or I mean, since that time, we've heard many, many different kinds of classes. Some much, much different than the way Prabhupada speaks. So you might hear some of the classes and think, What Prabhupada's saying seems to be quite straightforward, quite simple, and so forth. But when you were with Prabhupada listening to him speak, when he said the most simple thing, it would just like shake you up. Because we understood that when Prabhupada said something, he was actually seeing it and experiencing it, and you could feel it. You know, like, how many times have you heard a class where someone says, you're not the body. You're part and parcel of Krishna, you're a servant of Krishna. Hundreds, thousands, right? So at a certain point, you just kind of go dull. You've heard it so much, right? Anything you hear a lot, your brain goes dull, right? Doesn't it? I've heard that a million times, right? So you're not the body, and especially in those days, we heard that a million times. But when Prabhupada would say it, it kind of shook everybody up. You got a realization that you never had gotten before. Said, wow. So even the most simple things had this huge, profound effect on us. You're not the body. You felt it. It was like, wow. Did you hear when Prabhupada said you're not the body? Did you feel that? Did you see that he was seeing that? When Prabhupada said Krishna is beautiful, could you feel that he was seeing Krishna? Devotees will say that. He said, yeah, I could see that, I could feel that. That when he said that, that he was saying what he was seeing. He was saying what he was feeling, and then it communicated. So it would shake us up. Which is not to say that there's not power in listening to Prabhupada on tape, but there is special power being personally present. To be in his presence and hear it at the same time. It went very deep. So, I want to stop now because some of you are tired and some of you look hungry. And I have many rounds to chant. But if you have any questions, you could ask. Yes.
Is Prabhupada allowed the birds to touch his feet?
Yeah. Yes. Prabhupada said the disciples can touch the feet of the spiritual master, but others should not. But when Prabhupada was getting ill, then some of the disciples felt it would better nobody touch his feet, that they would be transference of karma. So, also in 1977, when Prabhupada was very ill, then he stopped initiating. He said, in this condition, I can't do it. Meaning, you know, it's a burden physically. He's the only one that spread Krishna consciousness so widely. And yeah, it's obvious. What Prabhupada did is obvious. It's just that there's a lot of other gurus that have a history and a tradition, so they're kind of ingrained in the culture as big gurus, Ramakrishna and so forth. But it's just a matter of time before Prabhupada will overshadow them. Do you know that Vivekananda went to America maybe in the 20s? He's a disciple Ramakrishna. And I think he established the Vedanta Society. And so people in India thought that Ramakrishna did amazing work in the West. But if you grew up in the West, you never even heard of him. Or you might, I heard of the Vedanta Society once, but I think it was after I was a devotee. And I didn't even know it was him. So people had people thought that he had done extensive preaching work, but it's obvious that Prabhupada has done it, and it'll become more obvious. And as it becomes more obvious, Prabhupada's position amongst all the acharyas will be unique, because he was the one that did what no one else did. And you can't deny that, you can't avoid it. It's just a fact. Yes?
Why is God doesn't follow this, the duration of the class of the Shrimad-Bhagavatam and to the cure as Prabhupada used to do?
Why they don't follow? I don't understand.
But. Yeah, why? Because you just said that he gave the class for 30 minutes and then.
Oh, yeah.
We don't have that here.
Oh, why don't. It was a. I guess it was a tradition that unless you lived in Los Angeles, you wouldn't see it. Maybe it didn't get exported to other temples. I don't remember. That's a broader question, why. There may be some things that he did we don't do. There may be historical reasons why. He may have stopped doing them or instituted something else. One thing that Prabhupada had done during the class was when before they chanted the full mantra, they would chant each word and everyone would repeat. And then they would chant the mantra. Then they would chant the words again with the transliteration. I see nowadays people just chant the verse, then they chant the word meanings, and then the translation. But Prabhupada initially had them chant each word. So that's what I do. That's what I saw. Anything else? Prabhupada, no, he never installed Nisringadeva deities, but the prayers to Lord Nisringadeva, at least the Namaste Narasinghaya prayer that Prabhupada asked us to chant after there was a bomb threat on the Los Angeles temple. I don't know the details because I only heard about this. I wasn't in Los Angeles when this happened, but either they found a bomb or there was just a threat, and then Prabhupada gave Namaste Narasinghaya, and he said, chant that after every kirtan. It was probably 1970. But I'm not aware that he established any deities of Lord Narasinghaya. One of my godbrothers said that he didn't. I never saw any. Yeah, so,
why
he didn't? Oh, here, because of the attacks by Muslims. That he would, and once he was installed, there have been no attacks. Okay? We can finish? It's all right? Okay. Śrīla Prabhupāda ki jai, Gopremānande, Hari Hari Bol.